I am Marilyn, and I am an alcoholic.
Amen. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Alana. And I want to thank everybody that put any work into this wonderful, wonderful state line retreat. And I thank all the people who have spoken, because that is nourishment to my parched soul. And it's just been a wonderful weekend, so thank you for that. I was asked to talk about step two, one of my favorites. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I have this imagined scene that God, whom I've come to believe in, was up in wherever God resides, looking over that step two. You say Marilyn Slater's in Alcoholics Anonymous? St. Peter says, yeah, it's true. She has to be restored to sanity. And God says, what an order. I can't go through with it. But since I've been sober for a while, I come to recognize that as just a manifestation of alcoholic grandiosity. God could do it. So I think that I've always been a little bit hung up on this idea of being restored to sanity. I certainly realized that I was not a good example of sanity ever. And I certainly engaged in a lot of destructive drinking. But what is sanity anyway? Our AA literature talks about soundness of mind, living in reality, being able to produce some kind of constructive actions rather than destructive living, living in unreality. And there's a thing that's attributed to Einstein. People say he really didn't say it. People who sound like they know what they're talking about, and that was insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results each time. I certainly identify with that. Back in the old days, before Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't think I was insane, but I loved all the seven deadly sins, of course, and had some favorites. But one thing that I just seemed to do over and over again was tell a lot of lies. And I didn't know why that was so until years later in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just so desperate for people to say, I like you, I respect you, that I would do just about anything to get you to act like you liked me and respected me. There's a speaker down in Southern California, Evan D., that said, my higher power was the look on your face. And I thought, yeah, yeah. I just wandered around repeating this behavior. I had very few friends, maybe none. But I had married Bill. He was a scientist, and my higher power at that time was science. And he was kind of my one and only friend. Friend, in that sense of the word, was what I think Rick described as, what was it, a parasitic entanglement. I like that, yes. I always imagined it as being tick-like. I just attach and drain out your life. But I was a student at UCLA, and Bill was a scientist there, and I actually made a friend and somehow ended up trying to be what I thought she wanted me to be. And I would just tell her these stories. I made up a life, and she'd respond in a positive way, and I think, well, that's good. I'll keep going with this one. And one of the things was I told her about our cat, and our cat was indoor-outdoor and came in with some wounds. And I just was on kind of a roll, and I said, this cat came in and had a terrible rat bite and was all swollen. And so I I turned the kitchen table into an operating table, and I got sterile sheets, and I got the scalpel, and I lanced the wound and drained it. I packed it with antibiotics and stitched it up, and now the cat's doing fine. And she said, "You're amazing." Oh, my gosh, that I needed that so desperately. And so some other things to build my character in her eyes. And I made the mistake of inviting her to dinner, so I had to prepare Bill, and I told him some of these things that I said, "You have to go along with this, because, I mean, she's my friend." And he didn't say too much. So she and her husband came to dinner, and sometime in the evening, one of the things she said, "I want to see this amazing cat, the one that you performed the operation on." And Bill just sat there and said, "There was no operation." Oh, and it was downhill from there. I don't think I ever saw her again. I was paying the tab for that. Horrid embarrassment, not being able to keep a friend. But my action was to turn on Bill. "Why didn't you lie for me?" And he said, I don't lie. I don't tell lies." He said, "That's no excuse." And that was just such a pattern, just repeating destructive behavior, paying the tab, but not changing it. And that was such a biggie for me. And I was on a bus one time, and there was a person that, oh, she had a quaint little accent, and I thought, gee, I want her to like me, and what do I need to be that she would cause her to like me? And so I told her this fantastic story of being a Russian princess, and there was a lot of discrimination against royalty, and so I just really escaped with my life and some lot of precious jewels, and I've been living on them. And her comment was, well, she was getting happy, and I thought, good, we're on the right track. She likes me. But what she said was, "You're Russian? I'm Russian." And she began speaking to me in Russian. I will tell you, it is so hard to fake a foreign language you don't know. So she looked at me weird, and I was paying the tab. But instead of no longer lying, my solution was I signed up and studied Russian for a year at UCLA in case it happened again. And I built up hideous resentments. I hated my mother-in-law because in the later stages of my drinking, I had lost my career as a scientist. I was at home and had given birth to three little children and couldn't take care of them. The care I gave them was to drink a lot of beer and sit in the garage and plan how I was going to be in and go in the house and be a good mom. A couple of times, Bill came home from work and would find me out in the car with little kids in the car. And that line that I just hated, "What is wrong with you?" And like our previous speaker, Jeff was saying, how do you answer that? I didn't know what was wrong with me. But I kept doing it over and over again, this destructive drinking, this destructive behavior. And building up this hideous resentment because my husband, being a scientist and a rational man, moved his mother in to take care of the situation. And she did take care of things. She took care of the kids. She took care of Bill. She took care of the house. And talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I loathed her. And it was causing me hideous pain. But I didn't recognize that. It took me a long time to recognize that resentment is painful to me, not to you. It felt like punishment to the person I resented, but it wasn't. And so my solution for that was to find other people and tell them how horrible she was, to get them to hate her too. And that hardly ever happened. So I built up a resentment toward them. So that was is what I brought into the program, destructive drinking. I liked rock climbing. We were talking about that at Lakes Anonymous, and I'm sure that made all the difference in the world. And she introduced me to the program, get active, say yes to AA. This program will work for you if you work for it. And I began to say things to her like, I just don't believe in this spiritual part of the program. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. Just give lip service to it and get active in the program. And here's these basic steps. Let's read them. Let's read the big book. So nothing happened for a while, except I was staying sober and I was getting active in the fellowship, still mystified by the whole come to believe in a higher power thing. And I began to realize that that's passive wording. You can't make yourself believe in something. When we say we take these steps, it sounds like it's an action. All right, I don't believe. Somebody says, believe. Okay, now I believe. No, it doesn't work that way. It's passive. If I'm going to come to believe, all I can have is trust. I can trust what people are talking about in Alcoholics Anonymous, and then maybe something will happen to me. It's trust, that kind of belief. And so then the next thing that happened was that I was at Ohio Street, a little meeting house down in Los Angeles, and I was an old-timer by that time. I was about a year and a half sober, and somebody walked up to me, and she said her name was Diana, and she said, I'm really new, and I don't think I belonged here. My case is really different. And, oh, I just laughed inside. I tried not to express it, but I could see that she was just like everybody else in the room. I could tell. And I thought, in my old-timerhood, I will convince her. I said, tell me about it. Just tell me, why do you think your case is different? And she said, well, I'm an atheist. And I said, gee, I am too. And she said, I'm some kind of scientist. And I said, oh, I am too. I didn't tell her about crashing and burning in the lab. She said, but I'm married to a professor. And I said, oh, so am I. Well, I have three children. Oh, so do I. And she went on. She said, I'm from the Midwest. Oh, so am I. And she said, but, you know, it's a funny thing. I love the German language, and I like to speak German, and I just love the German language for some reason. And I said, oh, so do I. And we began speaking a little German to each other. And then the coup de grace, she said, but I went to the University of Chicago. And I said, oh, so did I. And at that point, we just looked at each other, and we knew our case was different. And I confess that we just kind of went over into a corner and judged everybody else for a while. But what was happening was that we both had sponsors who insisted that we go to lots of meetings, like my glasses always slip down, so I have to keep doing that. So we were both active, and because of that, we just heard story after story of things that can't possibly happen, given the clientele. I kind of came in from my garage and after being in the dark and drinking all the time. And we just have these motley paths. And yet something happens here that doesn't happen anyplace else in the world. People recover. They take up their beds and walk. They become useful people. They practice sanity. They're no longer self-destructive. They are restored to sanity. And we just had to accept that we don't know why it happens. It doesn't seem all that logical, but it does. And we became believers. And we both jumped in, and we've both been active ever since. She moved to New York some time ago, but we're still close friends after these many years. And that's been a great gift of sobriety, a good, good friend. I didn't have friends before because I could never be honest with them. So the person they met was not the person that was there. But with Diana, I was honest. and it was safe, and she was honest with me, and we became together just intrigued by this whole idea of higher power, and what could that all mean? And I heard Chuck Chamberlain at the time, and he knew something that I didn't know, but it was a big thing. And I wanted to know that, and one day I just said a prayer, not thinking really that anything was there, but just on the chance, if you're there, I said, I'd like to get to know you. I'd like to have experience of you. And if you're really there, I'm willing to go on any path you pick for me. Now, I thought that was a big concession to whatever might be listening, but it had already happened. I'd turned my will and my life over to this program long before and was cooperating with it. The brain was just finally catching up, wanting to make an admission of it, but also wanting to know, what is this thing that Chuck Chamberlain knows? Well, what happened? And I don't know whether it was related to that request, I'd like to get to know you. I think it was a result of taking these steps. But around that time, that was when we were emerging from the 60s, and Diana had a lot of interest in the Eastern religions, Buddhism and whatnot, and there was a saying in Buddhism, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. And I said, what does that mean? And her interpretation and other, it has many interpretations apparently. I'm not a Buddhist, so I don't know, but I have been told that if there is a higher power, which we, most of us, come to believe, then it's just got to be so smart, so big, so complex, that whatever we understand here is probably going to be inadequate. But we do have epiphanies now and then, and we sense that something big is happening. That's meeting the Buddha on the road. That's coming into a relationship and knowing. But it's going to be inadequate. So kill that idea, or it does automatically get killed, and then we get moved to something a little bit more complex, a little bit more profound. So what happened was that I was lapsed around my second birthday into an abyss of pain, and I've since that time known many people that go through these periods of just dark nights of the soul. And sometimes it's just stretched over years and years. My friend and Diana sort of experienced it in a more measured way. It just took years and years, but mine started bubbling up to the surface at once, no doubt because of inventories and hearing stories, but I felt like I was going insane. I was in so much psychic pain that I don't think I normally could have lived through that, but another saying is that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And my teacher at that time was the one that Sharon, in her wonderful talk, alluded to. We had a friend, Bill B., that a couple of times would say, I just felt so different. I just imagined the spaceship was going to land and the doors would whir open and there would be a voice that would say, we've come to take you home, Bill. And because he said that, I thought, he's a scientist. And he was a technical person, and so I could listen to him. And he had gone through such a period, and he talked me through that time. I was in the kind of despair where I thought, there's no way out. This is never going to end. And I must be doing something terribly wrong to feel this bad day after day after day after day. And he said, no, this is a wonderful thing. You are being healed. We all come into the program with many things buried deep inside that are terribly wrong. And that has to surface and get processed and sorted out. God is taking those broken psychic bones and resetting them. And of course it's painful. It's a kind of psychic surgery. But it's a great gift, this thing that you're going through. And you will come into some kind of knowledge that you never had before if you just lived through this. And it was so encouraging to me. It gave me hope that there might be an end to it, although given to my own devices, I couldn't have believed that. And it took a long while, but around my third birthday, I was just kneeling, saying, God, if you're there, I want out. I just couldn't stand it anymore. And it's very difficult to describe, but somehow something broke open, some veil parted, and I came into contact with a God of my very own. And it was just so obvious when it happened. It was, why, you've been there all along. But I couldn't see until I could see, and I couldn't hear until I could hear. And that was a funny thing, because I thought, ah, this is it. I have arrived, and I will never have a problem again. It's wonderful. Now, in part, that was true, because now I did come to believe in this power, that this power would restore me to sanity, would clean up my act, would help me get rid of those things that have caused so much pain. I had a foundation, something firm to land on when the times were hard. And I thought it would be that way forever. But that was just the first big epiphany. And so life went on, and I was active in AA. And as with just about every other story, I began to make amends to the family and get reacquainted or acquainted for the first time with my husband and the children and grow up with them. I went back to work. I went back to school. And life became good. And I've noticed something lately. And a couple of people in these talks have alluded to this, that sometimes good times are much worse for us than the bad times. I know when there's tragedy, when there's disgrace, when there's failure, those of us that love the program turn to the program, we're comforted by our friends, we dig in more deeply than ever. But when times are good, there's this easy feeling that, well, I can lighten up on AA because I've got a lot of work to do, I've got this important job, I'm having a lot of fun with the family, I just don't have very much time for AA, they don't really need me. What was setting in on me was, is that all there is? I had a job, it was good, I wasn't enthusiastic about it, and the kids were growing up and they had friends of their own and they weren't all that pleased to be climbing with mom and doing stuff anymore. And it was like that Peggy Lee song. You're young, you probably don't remember, but she used to sing, is that all there is? Is that all there is, my friend? And that was kind of how I felt. But at that time, Susie, our youngest, had graduated from high school and went off to Israel with her friend, and who was an Israeli, and she lived on a kibbutz for about a half a year, learned Hebrew. So before she came back to the States, I joined her, and she was my tour guide for about 2 weeks in Israel. And something happened there. That was the next big thing in sobriety for me, and in my coming to believe, coming to know something. And I don't know why it happened, but it certainly involved my higher power. And if you think about it, if God wants to do something, God often does it in Israel. I mean, now, I didn't have a burning bush, but mine was momentous in that I had another epiphany, a realization. Susie was standing on the Sea of Galilee, this historical sea, and her arms were outstretched just like that person in the Titanic, and the wind was blowing, and I took a picture of her, and I just thought, my Susie, my little Susie, all grown up, and the kids were growing up and out, and I'm not all that happy. What went wrong? What is wrong? Am I not so grateful for sobriety anymore? And I was moved to make a prayer, and I just kind of apologized to God, and I said, you know, I have received so much, and my life is in order, and I'm grateful to some extent, but I'm pretty much of a taker. I've just been taking all these years. and I've not given back an awful lot. Can you help me? Can you use me? And my prayers had been, help me, give me, thank you. But now for the first time, I just said, use me. And I got enthusiastic. I thought maybe that would happen. Maybe that prayer would be answered. And then I began to think further, and I began to realize that, you know, I'm going to be sent to Calcutta. Mother Teresa, she was living at that time and doing wonderful things, and I got excited about that. And I told Susie, and Susie just said, that's interesting, Mom. Yes, interesting. And then I came back to the States with Susie and told my AA friends, and they humored me. They said, well, that sounds good, but you're not a Catholic. You're married with a family. You don't know any of the languages of India. Maybe it's not Calcutta. Maybe it's closer to home. Maybe it's something in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to think about that, and I realized there is a Calcutta. It is the Pacific Group in Los Angeles. And it has its very own Mother Teresa, Clancy I. And instead of the poorest of the poor, it's the sickest of the sick. It's where I got sober. And that is the last resort. They used to talk about cars driving by, just a drive-by, throw them out right in front of Clancy's house. And so I threw myself back into the Pacific Group. I'd done quieter AA for a while and gone back to school and went to meetings there at UCLA. And I just went back to the Pacific Group, my birthplace, the religion of my childhood, and went to 7 meetings a week, went to all the activities, just got fully immersed, just like a newcomer. And I began to experience the kind of joy I had never known before. And I began to sponsor women, a lot of women. And I was sponsoring women at the time, and I told them what I'm doing. Come with me to the Pacific Group. And they just made that Dracula sign, you know. No, I need quieter AA. And so I kind of lost them. But I began to sponsor women in the Pacific Group. And it was very easy because we have classes. Like, I'm class of 72. And I don't know whether you do that in your home group, but it's kind of nice because you grow up with the people who get sober in the same year and know your classmates. And there's a lot of peer pressure. And if you're a parasite like me, you are desperate for approval and you attach to your sponsor and you do these things. And I was just doing this. And when I was new, I was doing all of those things for approval, of course, because God used that. But I was getting yelled at a lot because I was so uncivilized, telling all those lies and cutting into line and just being just a jerk and awful. And so I was treated to what I call the bad dog form of sobriety. Like, I just cut into a coffee line once, and an old-timer, Harvey A., said, "You cut into line. We don't do that around here." And I said, "You have to be nice to me, because I'm a newcomer." And he said, "I am being nice to you. I'm helping you. And if you cut into line, people won't like you, so I am being nice to you. Bad dog, bad dog, bad dog." And unless people talked to me like that, I just didn't hear them. And so it was effective. But now I was back again in the Pacific Group, and I was sponsoring these newcomers, and I could say, "Bad dog, bad dog." It was so much fun. And then I had another period, just a long stretch, where everything was just okay and good, but with more enthusiasm, because I was much, much more active in Alcoholics Anonymous, which finally, after all those years, I learned was a well-kept secret, I guess. At least I didn't hear it. The more you do in AA, the happier you are and the more you get done on the outside. I liked work. I liked everything. But I especially love participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my beloved sponsees, Sally from the East Coast, was such an amazing person. She was doing social work, and she liked that. She was a good, kind person, but she really loved art history. And she went back to school to study art history, and it was made easy. It worked out with her job. She was given a little scholarship, and I said, see how God is working in your life. And I just began to see the support that she was getting. And it was that kind of thing that when something is meant to be, you get a lot of help doing it. And when the door is closed, we come to take that as God has something else in mind. Look for another door. But doors were opening up for her, and she went to school. She went to graduate school and got a PhD in art history. And then she got a wonderful postdoc, postdoctoral study, and we said, see how God is working in your life. It was a wonderful stipend, and she could do that and do research, live in that academic environment, what she had so loved and wanted to do. And she would come to Los Angeles and be my tour guide. We went to all the museums, and this was a love affair that just wouldn't quit. And then the miracle happened. She was offered a tenure track position in a university, the dream of every academic, and she began to think about the courses that she would be teaching. And one day I was talking to her, and she had a pain right in the middle, and I said, well, go to the doctor just to get that reassurance that everything's going to be okay. And she went to the doctor, and the doctor did some tests and talked about a mass. Now, that's not what you want your doctor to say usually, mass. So she had some exploratory surgery, and the diagnosis was an aggressive form of pancreatic cancer. And I was dumbstruck. I couldn't say, see how God is working in your life anymore. I felt betrayed. I had a crisis of faith. This God that I had come to know wouldn't do anything like that. See how God is working in your life. This is ridiculous. I mean, she could do so much good in that position. And I must say that Sally handled it so much better than I did. She just went into some kind of acceptance, and it was beautiful to watch. And she set a great example for me, but I was still so shattered by this experience because it just did not conform with what I had imagined. It was my higher power meeting my Buddha on the road. Well, that one had to die because it was not adequate. And the amazing thing is, daughter Susie, the one I went to Israel with, was the one that had the answer for me. And I was telling her about that, and she had had her own spiritual awakening. She's not an alcoholic, but through teaching at a religious school, Notre Dame. And she is an academic, and she said, you know, what you're telling me about your sponsee, your friend, the one you love, Sally, reminds me of a long time ago when Pa, that's what they called their dad, Pa, read stories to us. He would read Winnie the Pooh to us. And I remember the story. One time, Piglet said to Winnie the Pooh, what is your favorite thing? What is your favorite thing to do? And Winnie the Pooh said, eating honey. And then he thought, and he said, no, it's that moment before eating honey. And Susie said, Sally has that moment before eating honey. And Susie had already taken a position, had a tenure track position, was teaching in a medical school, and just in agony over faculty meetings and bickering and grating and students protesting. And there's this saying, why are academic politics? It was somehow a gift. I realized that this is my chance to really make amends to him, to care for him. And I'm just so happy that I loved every minute of that, to be at his side and express that to him. In the last several months, he was on hospice care. And I was holding him one night and just telling him that I loved him. And he really had begun to think that he was on the way out. And he was a little bit frightened. And I said, meet me on the other side. And he was a scientist, and he just had no belief in any kind of a higher power. But I was able to talk to him about that, and I could see the kind of glimmer of hope in his eyes that there may be something beyond this. And I think that he heard my certainty about that, that we are safe here and in the hereafter. I said to him before he lapsed into unconsciousness and was still lucid, I said, I love you. And he looked at me and he said, a perfect marriage. No, not perfect, because it only lasted 60 years. And I just thought that's the sweetest thing I'd ever heard. And I'm grateful. I've lived a long life, and I'm grateful for that. But much more than that, I am grateful for my 47 sober years. And I wish you a long life, but more than that, I wish you continuous sobriety so that we can live in thankful contemplation of him who presides over us all. Thank you.